Hi, thank you guys all for coming. So my name's Katie, and I currently work for the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. I'm the research analyst with them. So today I'm going to talk about a little bit about chemical accidents in Louisiana related to oil and gas, and then how communities are responding and the tools that we use in conjunction with communities. So to give you a little bit of background, for those who don't know, the Louisiana Bucket Brigade is an environmental justice and health organization located in New Orleans. Our offices are just down the road if you guys want to come see. And we, our mission is to support fenceline communities in their work around oil refineries in Louisiana, and we primarily focus on issues of clean air. I don't have any relationships to disclose. So I don't even really need the slide. Jacob went over it really thoroughly. There's a lot of oil and gas in Louisiana, right? You saw all of his maps. And in particular, there are a lot of oil refineries in the state. We've got 17 in total, and again, as Jacob said, the area, the stretch of river between where we are right now in New Orleans and upriver in Baton Rouge is incredibly clustered with refineries, chemical plants, tons and tons of industry. And I should say that a lot of it is expanding with the shipment of natural gas from places like North Dakota and Canada. So it's expanding. We also have some of the largest refineries in the country. So this is a list of top oil refineries by refining capacity as of 2014. And we've got three out of the top 10. So Marathon Petroleum in Garyville, ExxonMobil in Baton Rouge, and Sitco Petroleum in Lake Charles. And we used to be higher up, but Texas keeps expanding theirs and bumping us down. But if you look at just these three refineries together, and keep in mind that we've got 17 total, these three alone are refining almost 1.5 million barrels of oil every single day, which is just a huge amount. So I wanted to talk a little bit about fence line communities and what we mean when we say fence line communities. And it's pretty...
Fence line,
yeah, right, good. I'm glad that I had this slide to clarify that. So it's pretty intuitive, but I wanted to illustrate the point that it's literal. People live very close to these facilities, often as little as a few feet away. So you can imagine how the industry impacts their life, their health, you know, everything. So again, this is an overview of ExxonMobil in Baton Rouge, which you'll remember from a few slides ago, is one of the largest in the country. And I wanted to make sort of two points with this slide. One is just the geographic extent of the refineries, how large they are, and then also how close communities live. So this is the community of Standard Heights, which is one that we have worked with for a long time. And you can see that that people live really close to this plant. And I also want to illustrate the point that more often than not, communities are being impacted by multiple sources, not just one. So in the Standard Heights example, they've got Exxon on one side of them, another chemical plant to the north, another to the south, and a rail yard on the other side. So communities are very often totally surrounded by this industry. And I guess the third point about this, and Jacob talked about it a little bit, is the historical kind of component to a lot of these refineries. So in Louisiana, a lot of plantations, most plantations, were located along the Mississippi River for access to shipping, and then now industry is also primarily located along that same river. So we see a really pretty literal jump from historic systems of power and oppression to more contemporary systems of oppression. And a lot of these facilities are located near predominantly African American communities and in many cases, historic freed slave communities. So disproportionate impact. These are just some statistics on percent African American and percent living below the poverty line. And you can see that in the majority of cases that we work with, communities living closest to the refineries are disproportionately African American and disproportionately low income. If we look at ExxonMobil, which was the plant that we were looking at in that previous slide, you can see that that the percentage of the community living below the poverty line within a mile of the facility is more than triple the parish-wide average. And parishes are our counties. And when you look at percent African American, again, it's more than double the parish-wide average, at more than 95% of the community. So again, this is a session about chemical accidents. This would be a very different story if these plants operated well and were well maintained, but we find that they are not. So these are some pictures from accidents around the state. And from our data, this is for 2013, refineries have an average of 6 accidents a week in Louisiana. And I always want to make the point that this is probably a significant underestimate of the actual number of accidents, because this is all based on self-reported data, right? So we always give the comparison that it's like if you were driving your car and the police asked you to call them every time that you sped, we probably wouldn't get exactly the right number on that. So these accidents that happen at refineries cause huge spikes in emissions, which then translate into severe public health impact. And you can see this is from refinery accidents from 2005 to 2011. Just to give you an idea of the amount that we're dealing with and also the types of pollutants that we're looking at. And luckily, I'm in a room full of public health folks, so you guys know. But we see a lot of sulfur compounds, a lot of volatile organic compounds coming off of these facilities, and those are related to a variety of both acute and long-term health implications. So I'm going to talk later in the talk a little bit about the community of Chalmette. So I wanted to give you an overview, and this again tells you shows you that communities are often dealing with multiple sources of pollution. So this is an overhead view of the town of Chalmette, which is pretty close to where we are right now, and you can see that there are 3 major facilities neighboring them. So we've got Valero, which was formerly Murphy Oil, right here. We've got Chalmette Refining, which was formerly ExxonMobil here. And then here there's a little facility called Rain CII, which actually isn't an oil refinery, but it does it processes petroleum coke, which is arguably even worse. So it's a little guy, but it has a pretty huge pollution output. So talking about chemical emergencies specifically in St. Bernard Parish, Joy Lewis, who's formerly from Chalmette, was going to talk about that. So I wanted to include a few of her slides in mine. You can see, again, these are the type of things that people are experiencing and living with every day. So fires at the plant, continuous flaring. And for those who don't know, flaring is when a facility has to burn off an amount of product. And they like to say that it's burning really efficiently and that no pollution is getting into the communities, but that's not true. And in this picture right here, you can see a flare that's operating improperly and sending a lot of pollution and smoke into the neighborhood. We also, a lot of community members talk about a soot, so a particulate matter that's coming down, you know, on their cars and their communities. Facilities often buy people car washes when they complain about that. So gives you an idea of what the refinery's responses usually are. So again, as Jacob said, these facilities are hugely susceptible to weather events. And we're in Louisiana, you can reasonably expect that there are going to be some weather events that we're experiencing. However, we see that in many cases, refineries continue to operate throughout the storm, and that the failure to operate by safe shutdown procedures means that there are really huge spikes in emissions. So this is one that Jacob referenced. During Hurricane Katrina, Murphy, which is now Valero, they had a huge accident. They had a storage tank that was full of crude oil that got totally lifted up, dislodged, and emptied its entire content into the surrounding community. So over 1 million gallons of crude oil went into this community neighboring the facility. This is from a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services report about the spill. So this is within someone's home in the community. You can see here, this is where the level of water and oil came in their home. And so essentially, the oil mixed with the floodwaters and mud and then went into people's homes and seriously contaminated their homes. And Joy always talks about how she and her husband went back to their home to try to get all of their belongings that they needed. A lot of folks needed, you know, to get medicines, they needed to get things, and so they went in and waded through this really toxic stuff and were really significantly exposed. So from that report, they estimated that approximately 1,800 homes were impacted by this spill. The spill also impacted canals and contaminated soil in the neighborhood. However, I just want to point out that the Department of Health survey said that the contaminated sediment and the community members' exposure did not pose a public health hazard, which is pretty incredible. So to transition into some of the tools that we use. So we're called the Bucket Brigade, right? So I wanted to talk a little bit about our namesake bucket. This is a man named Denny Larson with community members in Shreveport. He's kind of the godfather of all buckets. he helped develop this technology and is still working to get it out to folks. So it's an EPA-approved air sampling bucket, and basically what it does is you take a grab sample of air in one of these food storage buckets. We make them ourselves. They're really low cost. And so we train community members on how to sample their air when they're smelling pollution, and then they take the samples and ship them off to a lab. We pay for the analysis, and the samples are analyzed for volatile organic compounds and sulfur compounds, which, as you saw before, are a lot of the pollution that we see. And this is especially important because there aren't any air monitors in Louisiana that are measuring this data ongoing, and when the state sends folks out to monitor, it's often long after pollution has occurred, and so they don't get anything on their reading. So it's really important for communities to be able to do their own sampling. So this is from Chalmette, an example of folks who were really diligent about bucket sampling. They took 24 samples in the years of 2003 and 2004, which is a large number. And in the majority of the samples, they found pollutants in excess of health protective standards. So this is an example from one bucket sample taken on 6/29/2004, and you can see all of these were in violation of EPA and Louisiana health standards, and you can see some of the concentrations that we're talking about and some of the compounds that communities often find. So whenever a refinery has an accident that releases pollution in excess of their permit limits and of the reportable quantity, they're required to submit an accident report to the state of Louisiana, which details what happened in the accident, how much was released, things like that. So this is called an unauthorized discharge form, and this is what they usually look like. They're on letterhead. They, you know, have some information about the accident. And the state makes these publicly available on their own system. However, it's incredibly difficult to use. There are often multiple reports for a single accident. They don't combine those reports. You have to look for the reports using an incident ID, which is just six random numbers, so it's really hard to, it's just not very intuitive. So we didn't like their system, so we made our own system called the Refinery Accident Database. It's available publicly online at that URL. And what we do is we take all of those accident reports quarterly and we input them into our own system. And this really enables us and community members to look at not only particular accidents, but also trends in accidents, so we can do advocacy around those issues. It's an incredible resource. We've got almost 10 years of data at this point, so, and it's available online if anybody would like to use it as a data source. We also have the eyewitness pollution map. So refineries, whenever they submit accident reports, they're supposed to say whether or not their accident resulted in any offsite impact, and I've looked at a lot of those reports, and I have never seen one where they've admitted offsite impact. So we developed a tool on a mapping platform called Ushahidi. I can talk more about how the map kind of works if people are interested. But basically what it is is it's attempting to collect data on the true offsite impact of refinery accidents. So community members call or report or text a number, or they can email their reports of pollution every time that they smell something, they see a flare, if they feel any health effects. And then we go through those reports and then they get uploaded onto this map. And you can see that the red circles correspond to number of reports. As you zoom in, they kind of spread out, and you can see specifically where the report was made from. That shows a report that says that there was no offsite impact of a spill of about 10,000 pounds of sulfur dioxide. So, where community members report every time they see, smell, hear, or feel pollution, and we ask that they include in their reports a description of the event, where they were when they experienced the pollution, any associated health effects, wind direction, and then they also are able to upload photos or videos of the event. So this is from flaring at a refinery in Norco from a few weeks ago. Also on our map, we include reports made by the facilities to the National Response Center, which is their first point of contact after an accident. So that way we're able to look at refinery self-reported data and how that links up or doesn't link up with community impact. We also conduct door-to-door outreach to encourage reporting because, you know, you can have the best tool in the world, but if folks aren't using it, then it's not really worth much. So we go out after accidents in response to accidents, do health surveys, and we tell people about the map and encourage reporting. And it's a kind of combining high tech with really traditional community organizing techniques. So there are other places that community members can report this pollution. And the state of Louisiana, the Department of Environmental Quality, has a hotline where you can call, but this is from a few weeks ago. They're only accepting calls on Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., so if you're being exposed to chemical pollution, make sure it's between those hours. Otherwise, DEQ is not going to help you out. So, obviously, that's a big flaw in the state system and one that we think is better with ours. You can call our number at any point. Also, these reports, they are publicly available, but you would have to submit a FOIA request, so there's also a little bit of lack of transparency, and we like that our system is live online all the time. So this is a flowchart about how reports from the map are used. I'll just kind of touch on a few, but really they are used in a variety of ways. So first response, reports to the map are usually our first information about a chemical accident, especially in places that are a little bit further away from New Orleans. And we also have participated in incident command, so they're being used by first responders responding to these chemical emergencies. Community engagement, again, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gone out to communities and spoken with people who thought that it was a natural gas leak in their house. So it's really powerful for people to see where others have been reporting, not only to know whether or not there's a potential, you know, chemical accident that they need to respond to keep themselves safe, but also as an organizing tool. Enforcement, we send these reports to folks at the state and EPA weekly. In monitoring and evaluation, it's the MAP reports have been used to support public health research on true health impacts. So I'm going to go through some of the things that I think the MAP does a really good job of. And the first thing is shifting the discussion and the narrative around these accidents. So the first thing is that the reporting to the MAP is narrative. You know, it's important to have hard numbers and data, but it also is really important to validate the real lived experience of fence line communities, especially in a state where that, you know, people are routinely told that there's not a problem, there wasn't an accident, they shouldn't be experiencing what they're experiencing. And again, it's collecting data on the true health impact, which, as far as I know, is not being collected in any other way. And it also facilitates media reporting on these accidents and kind of shifts the tone of that. Oftentimes when you hear about stories of chemical accidents, if there's any information from a community member, it's usually like a little clip at the end. But having this map and, you know, having sort of a cool visualization facilitates reporting and kind of changes that story. This is a community member in St. Rose who is participating in a press conference. This is an article from a local newspaper about the accident in St. Rose, and it featured several community reports. So again, it also provides us a little bit of data to send to enforcement officials. So we link up community reports with bucket samples, with industry reports, and with news stories, and we send those all of that information really well packaged to enforcement officials with the hope that they will enforce. And again, this is documenting a problem. A lot of times when we go out and talk to people, we usually say, have you smelled anything within the last week? And people laugh at us because, you know, the question should be, did you smell anything yesterday? So We know that pollution is really impacting communities, but that without that documentation piece, it's really difficult to advocate for change. It counters the narrative that problems have been resolved. So really quickly, Martha is going to talk a lot more about what happened in St. Rose, but this, I think, was a really great example of the map working well. So community members there have continued to report about an ongoing pollution problem. And this is number of reports per week from St. Rose, and then the date here. And you can see that on July 9th, we received a letter from the Environmental Protection Agency saying that the pollution odors in St. Rose had been resolved. Don't worry about it anymore. We knew that wasn't true, but the only way that we were able to say that definitively and to communicate that to EPA was through these community member reports. So we can't do any of the work that we do without the reports that community members are making. And this is an example of a report from the beginning of October, and I made this chart a while ago, so there have been reports more recently than this, talking about some of the continued pollution in St. Rose and the continued health impacts. And I wanted to end with a success story, again from Chalmette. So they were an incredible community group, and they did a lot of advocacy and a lot of bucket sampling and reporting, and they were organized in amazing ways, and it can lead to real success. So they were instrumental in getting the Chalmette Vista Monitor put up by the state. This is a monitor that's running 24/7, collecting data on methane, particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, and hydrogen sulfide, which really is something that we need in all of our communities, but that's the result that we can have with some of this work. And I think we're holding questions till the end, but I just want to say thank you. There's my contact information and ways to report to the map if you smell anything weird during your time in New Orleans, which wouldn't surprise me. Thanks.